This week on Two Legs, we are joined again by Alan Cozen for part two of our look of Paul McCartney's classical work with this guy right here, Standing Stone.
And also Alan will be giving us an update on the McCartney Legacy, a two-volume set that he is currently producing right now with Adrian Sinclair, covering McCartney's career from 1969 to the present day. And the first volume is from 69 to 73. And we're also looking forward to hearing about that too.
Stay tuned. McCartney fans, and welcome to another edition of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with Paul's solo career. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, where myself and my other three co-hosts just, you know, talk about the solo career of the Beatles, and we have a lot of fun doing that. And joining me, as always, is my newly relocated side, my partner in crime, one Mr. Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Good to see you again, my friend.
Yeah, good to see you, too. Hope everything has been going all right with the start of the new year for you.
Yes, sir. Up and running.
Okay, cool. And you may be wondering who this other gentleman with us is today, and you may have heard him a lot, but you may not have seen him unless you frequently fasten all the symposiums that have been going on a lot lately these last few years. And he's Alan Cozen. He's the author of The Beatles, Cavern to the Rooftop, and Got That Something, How the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Changed Everything. He also spent many years working in the classical department for the New York Times, and he is one of the three co-hosts of one of my favorite podcasts, Things We Said Today. Alan, how are you doing? Welcome.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Andy. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thanks. Thanks, well, Alan.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. We're going to do part two of our look at Paul's classical music. Alan was kind enough to join us for part one with our look at the Liverpool Oratorio, and he's agreed to join us for part two, this time with Standing Stone. But this time, first let me just get a couple things out of the way. One, if you haven't noticed any Facebook posts from us lately, it's because for some reason, one reason or the other, our Facebook page got unsubscribed or unpublished, however you want to say. So I got a new Facebook page up, so please head over to our Facebook page and like, so you can see all the upcoming shows and all the great songs and stuff we like to publish on that page. So we appreciate that. Also, Alan, big congratulations to you and your partner Adrian Sinclair on the book deal for the McCartney Legacy series. We're going to get into that a little bit after our look into Standing Stone. But first, I just wanted to ask you a question about Things We Said Today, because, like I said, it's one of my favorite podcasts out there.
Oh,
and you've been a great addition to the show. I've been listening to the show, I think, since 2012. And you came on, what, was it 2015, was it?
Probably 14 or 15, yeah, something like that.
Right. And the thing I love the most about listening to you is you just make it sound so effortlessly, you know. Even if it's something so complicated, you just make it, you know, seem so easy to talk about. And I was just curious, I mean, do you do a lot of research for that show? I mean, do you memorize a lot of this stuff since you lived a lot of it? Or, I mean, you know,
yeah, you know, it depends on the topic. I mean, obviously, if we have an author on, I read whatever the book we're going to talk about is. So we had Peter Asher recently, and that's a great thing because it helps me keep up with books that I would want to read but might not necessarily get to, except that we have the show, so it's a good reason to do it. And you know, if it's a topic, you know, obviously the Beatles themselves are a vast topic at this point. I mean, this is the Beatles as a group broke up 50 years ago, and since then, the four of them, well, John until 1980, George till 2001, but they've put out an awful lot of stuff and done an awful lot, and so it becomes increasingly hard to keep tabs on all of it. So you know, I think we all do a little refreshing before we do the show. But a lot of the stuff we just know as well. It depends, you know, if it's a Beatles topic, I'm usually sort of ready to go at any point.
Right. For instance, like the last episode on all the compilations. I mean, you were pretty. I mean, you sounded like you just were listening to them just recently. I mean, it sounds just like you knew all the information right away, like you didn't even have to look it up. You know, it just sounded so, you know, fluent. You know.
Well, yeah, I mean, those were fun. I mean, those are records that we've all had for all these years. And I think, as I said on the show, I mean, my attitude towards compilations is a little different than, say, Ken's, you know, because I'm not that concerned about the business of finding new listeners, although obviously it's an important thing. So, you know, for me, the big attraction of them is, you know, the odd weird mixes on this compilation or that compilation. And so normally I wouldn't have wanted to do compilations as a topic, but as Darren brought it up, and as I began thinking about the history of the compilations and how they've changed over the years and what the Beatles' attitude and Apple's attitude towards them was, it just seemed like it would be a good topic to do. So we did that one.
Cool.
As you know, it can be hard coming up with topics that you haven't already done. You know?
Right.
Well, I mean, you guys are already well over 300 episodes, so yeah. That's right. I mean, I guess.
I think I'm one or two behind. The most recent one I listened to was on the best of what you liked in 2019 and what you want for 2020. That was a good show. I don't know if that was two shows ago, but that was a good one too. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, I think Peter Asher might have been in between.
Right.
And Peter Asher is, you know, he's great. I interviewed him for the McCartney Legacy book as well, and he's very frank and very open, and he's a good guy. And besides, I'm not Peter and Gordon fan, so that was fun to do.
I enjoy his segment on his on the Beatles Sirius channel whenever he's on and he has his show. I don't know if you have a chance to listen to that, but I always love listening to his anecdotes on that show. It's always a pleasure listening
Absolutely.
To Peter talk about those late Apple days, the beginning of Apple, and his career up to that point. So I always enjoyed listening to Peter, and I'm looking forward to hearing that episode as well that you did.
Good. Great.
So just off the top of your head, I mean, are you looking forward to possibly any 50th anniversary sets besides Let It Be? I mean, this 2020 is pretty much starting the 50th anniversary of, you know, the main, if you want to call it, solo careers of the Beatles. I mean, do you see a possibility of like a Beaucoup de Blues and Sentimental Journey 50th anniversary? Or I'm really hoping for an All Things Must Pass 50th anniversary myself. But I mean, and I would also love to see a Plastic Ono Band set, kind of like
Absolutely.
The Imagine from 2018.
Yeah. I think you mentioned that, Alan, too, and on Things We Said Today, if he did a Plastic Ono Band box like the Imagine box that we got last year, that would be a nice treat for 2020.
Yeah, I'd like that for everything. I mean, as someone who has spent his life also as a bootleg collector, I would be perfectly happy to have the tracks from an official source. I mean, not only because the sound is likely to be better, although bootlegs, there's some pretty good ones out there, but also because, you know, it's their stuff, they want to sell it to me. Even if I've already got it as a bootleg, I'm happy to get it again. And you know, I think I think these anniversary sets with all of the extra tracks, and Ringo has said in interviews about Abbey Road, for instance, that he's not that keen on all the extra tracks, so I think we might not hear Sentimental Journey and Buku's Blues box set, sadly. But, you know, as someone who spent his life as a music critic as well, those outtakes give you a lot of perspective on how they did what they did. And how they did what they did is, for me, you know, the main question to get to the bottom of in, you know, the entire universe. So, you know, the more box sets, anniversary box sets, or non-anniversary box sets, the better. Mm-hmm.
And what are your hopes for the Let It Be set?
Well, I do think that they should put out the complete set of Niagara Reels.
Plus, all 86 or 87 discs or whatever it is.
Something like 87 discs, I think. Yeah. If you look at AB Road, which is probably about the most efficient way to get them, because they edited the A and B reels, and you know. But the thing is, those last few days, if you look at the Let It Be sessions, I mean, and I could see why a more casual listener might not want all the Niagaras, because you start in with them, you know, sitting around doing little jams, messing about, and then, you know, Paul or John or whoever song it is calling out the chords and the other guys start playing. And, you know, that might not be that interesting for everybody. It's pretty interesting for me. But also, you know, I would hope that they include some of those particularly magical moments, like when, you know, Paul tells Mal to be ready with a pencil and pad in hand, and they're going through Get Back, and he, you know, stops it and says, okay, I got it. JoJo left his home in Tucson, Arizona. And John says, is Tucson in Arizona? And Paul says, yeah, it's where they did High Chaparral. I mean, that kind of thing is gold. You know, you're seeing a song that you know really, really well being written right in front of you, you know. So, in fact, I'd love if Peter Jackson had the footage of that, too, and put that in. That would be great. So yeah, you know, I just hope they come up with a good selection, possibly showing some of the different ways they approach these songs. Like, you know, you've heard, I'm sure there's like a really fast electric version of Get Back, and also Two of Us. So these songs went through lots of changes during that period. And I think that that period being really, I mean, a month, except they had a week off because of George leaving, and so it's really only 3 weeks. If you think about that, you know, it's a lot of stuff. It's 87 discs on AB Road, but it's really only 3 weeks worth of material where they come in from, you know, with these songs from scratch, except for something like One After 909, which they've been playing for quite some time. And they take it all the way through to a finished album with lots of different ways of approaching it. I'd love to see some of that. And then with the Peter Jackson film, you know, like I said, if they have that Get Back writing scene, that would be cool. And some of the jams and things, I think the idea is to show sort of the other side of the sessions, because we know the one where they're fighting and miserable, and we've been hearing, you know, John's interviews about that ever since then, and Paul and George too. But as you know, you participate in something, and you may have a particular view of how it went, but if you revisit it a couple of decades later, you might see that the reality was a little bit different than what you remember, because you're freighted with a lot of baggage about everything else going on. You know, for Paul, it was the whole Alan Klein battle. For John, it was apart from sort of a slight heroin problem that had to do with the way that Yoko was being treated by the others, and George had his issues about no one really taking his song seriously, even though he brought in a stack of.
Oh, sorry about that, and what that was. Sorry. We'll edit that out.
Is that a train?
My other computer just came on. We'll edit that out. Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah, George wrote in a ton of really good songs. I mean, Hear Me, Lord, All Things Must Pass. A lot of the stuff that ended up on All Things Must Pass itself, plus things like Something, An Old Brown Shoe. So he was really cooking, and he was, I think, a little upset that nobody was picking up on these. So, you know, they each had reasons to feel not happy about those sessions. And yet, I think if they revisit them now, they may have a better attitude about them. Ringo is... always, you know, said he's fine about them. He thought it was fun. So we'll see, and then we'll be hearing from everybody about how the Peter Jackson one is a whitewash, and
Alan, do you think we'll get the Michael Lindsay Hoag original version somewhere in this collection somewhere when this comes out, or no?
Well, Apple announced that after the Peter Jackson version comes out, that the Michael Lindsay Hogg one will come out too. So, you know, I mean, that deserves a place too. That's it's one view of those sessions, and Peter Jackson's will be another view of the sessions. And in fact, you know, it would be really cool to see Michael Lindsay Hogg's original cut ran for about 3 hours. I'd love to see that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure that we won't hear or see, you know, Paul doing his original, you know, I don't know if it's original or not, his Get Back version where he's singing about the Pakistanis taking, you know, other people's jobs.
That won't be
Yeah, you know, here's the thing about that. I mean, I once got a call, I mean, when I was still at the Times, I got a call from someone in Rolling Stone who was doing an article about this, and this is the problem with, why I'm happy being a geezer, and not, you know, because someone who just sort of heard about this last Tuesday hears that, oh, well, you know, there's a song, and they said no Pakistanis and all that, but it was satire. It was a parody of the British National Front, and these, you know, sort of right-wing racist guys who, you know, who believed in that. I mean, if you listen to the rest of the Get Back / Let It Be sessions.
Doing White Power, singing White Power as well.
White Power and, you know, Enoch Powell and that whole thing. I mean, they were trying to do some satirical stuff, and I think they ultimately realized that people can take these things wrong. You know, I mean, unless you have someone explaining, you know, that this is what it is, maybe it didn't make sense to do. So I think they sort of revised Get Back into a normal song and dropped White Power Promenade, as it's called on bootlegs, and, you know, Commonwealth, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I remember I had a bootleg, I think it was called the Black Album, where I heard a lot of that stuff on there, and I was kind of shocked at first, and that, you know, understanding that, you know, what you're saying, that it was parody, and and I thought, this is gold, man.
That was awesome, actually.
But obviously we could talk about this for a couple hours. If, it is really a fascinating topic and subject. But let's get to this guy right here, Standing Stone.
Okay.
Paul's second, I won't say attempt, but it's his second full length release of original classical music. Now, when you were on for Liverpool Oratorio, I guess, you know, you would agree that for Paul McCartney, for a pop rock artist, that was pretty much a success, wouldn't you agree, for someone of his stature to take on something like that?
I personally thought so, but I was, I believe, the only one of my colleagues who did. It didn't fare that well in the classical world at all, and I'm not sure how it fared among, you know, straight pop listeners. A lot of people obviously got it and, you know, tried to get into it because it was Paul. But, you know, the thing is that Liverpool Oratorio was really based on extended song forms, if you look at it. It was, you know, and that could be a Broadway musical or something if he were to revamp it a bit, you know, structurally. I mean, it's mostly there. You just need to get some staging. But, you know, it told a story. It was written in song forms. It had some very nice instrumental work. The big long violin solo. I thought this guy could write a concerto, and he should. but I think it was successful. I don't know how to describe whether it was successful or not, because not that many of the reviews, apart from mine, were very positive. And I felt a little bad about that. That said, I didn't like Standing Stone as much.
Okay. I agree. I agree. Yeah. I liked the oratorio better than Standing Stone myself.
Right. But like the oratorio, this work, which I think he was commissioned in 1994, which is what he was looking for to do another piece, since he did enjoy the oratorio.
One of the things I like to do when I assess McCartney's career, especially from 25 years ago or longer, is just contextualize the period from which it came and analyze what was going on.
Where I was going to go.
And why was it commissioned? What else was he juggling at the time? Because I don't really know a whole lot about Standing Stone. I bought it when it came out. I was young at the time. So I'm always very curious to contextualize the era from which this work came, because it kind of came from during a period when there was a lot of stuff going on. And I'm just curious on your thoughts about mid-90s. I mean, he had just finished the Off the Ground tour with that era had ended, and then he's starting this, and then doing all kinds of, and then I think he had that performance of Leaf also during this time in 95, so there was a lot going on.
Yeah, you know, he's working up for his own stuff. He's working up for his Flaming Pie, and
Right around the same time. The Ballad of Skeletons was right around the same time. We're also working on Tropical Island Hum as well, so a lot going on.
There's always a lot going on with Paul. I mean, that guy doesn't rest. You know, he's always juggling a lot. And, you know, we'll talk about the book later. But, I mean, one thing we're finding is that he's always got enough ready to go for two or three albums. And every time he goes in and does sessions for an album, he sort of adds to that by multiple albums worth of stuff. There are whole inventories of things that no one has even heard. You know, you see the titles and you think, wait, what is that? You know? So, like, you pick on any period of his work and there's a lot going on. So to be doing a huge symphonic thing while also, you know, completing a tour, working up towards your next actual album, and then Tropical Island Hum, and, you know, all of these things. I don't know how he juggles it, you know.
Beatles Anthology, which took in a lot of time, too.
And the anthology, exactly, yeah, right.
But why was Standing Stone now? Was he asked to do it, another classical?
Yeah, he was commissioned, yeah.
He was commissioned by EMI, and I think the reason EMI commissioned it is because of the Liverpool Oratorio. They saw that, first of all, he was serious about this and wanted to do more of it, and, you know, in addition to the oratorio, I mean, he had a bunch of shorter pieces that were basically, you know, you could think of them as studies, you know, I mean, you know, it's, you know, okay, if I want to do this kind of piece, what kind of problems do I need to face in order to do it? And so Spiral and A Leaf and Stately Horn, a lot of these pieces were sort of to deal with those questions, and he ended up liking the pieces, and so they came out, a lot of them, on Working Classical. And when he performed Standing Stone in New York, some of those pieces were also on the concert. You know, he was commissioned by EMI. I imagine that, you know, the sales of Liverpool Oratorio were sufficient that they felt comfortable commissioning him to do this piece. No information has come out about, you know, what the commissioning fee was or anything like that. And I don't think that even mattered to Paul,
Right.
I think it was, you know, EMI was committed to recording what he wanted to record, and he wanted to do this, and they knew he was serious. I did speak to John Fraser, who produced, I think, all of his classical stuff. And, you know, he was a classical producer. He knew what went into classical recordings and classical pieces. And he was suitably impressed with Paul's efforts and seriousness. So I think that's why EMI went ahead. I think, you know, if you're someone like Paul McCartney and you're signed to a label like that, the label wants to keep you, and it wants to keep you happy. And if what he wants to do, seeing as he's going to be doing his, you know, rock albums anyway, if what he wants to do is a classical album every now and then, I think they're happy with that, because also it goes on to their classical label, which at the time was called EMI Classics. I've kind of lost track now because of Universal buying EMI and all that, what the classical label's called, because they folded it into a bunch of other
subsidiaries,
Warner labels and things, or whatever. The latest EMI sale is so confusing and happened after I retired that I didn't really have to deal with it. Although I imagine as we get up to that portion in the McCartney book, I'll have to sort it all out. I think that was the feeling, you know, because also keep in mind that, if it's going on to EMI's classical label, EMI Classics at the time, then it's also on that label's budget, which means that that label's sales are going to be reflecting the income from the sales of this, which are going to, almost by definition, sell more copies than, say, you know, Conductor X's new recording of the Beethoven Third. Great as the Beethoven Third is, but there are a gazillion of them on the market. You know, when I've done stories about the classical record business, which I used to do every few years at the Times, and before that at High Fidelity and Opus and other magazines, and they'd be sort of like big, in-depth things, and they never want to talk about record sales. But I was usually able to find someone at a company who would slip me a computer printout. And I was shocked. I mean, originally it was in the thousands, but the last one I did, which had to have been in the 90s, around the time this came out, the number one record was a recording of the Mozart Requiem. Incredible piece. Everyone knows it from Amadeus. Conducted by a very, you know, good, well-known conductor, and it was the number one classical record on the Billboard charts, and the international sales were 300 copies.
Wow.
You know,
perspective, because this was also a number one on the classical charts as well.
And it probably sold way more than 300 copies.
True. However, it did go to 194 on the pop charts, not doing as well as one of your favorite albums, Mr. Kozin.
That did better.
Yes, great.
Oh my God, it did do better. Wow.
Yeah. So anyways, so this was to celebrate EMI's centenary. And he started in 94. He has early, in September of 94, he has early versions of the first two movements. But then in early 95, he installs this, what, Cubase sequencing software on his Apple Macintosh, which I'm sure he got for free since it's an Apple. And, you know, they had their little conflicts in the past. But, I mean, I would imagine then him not being able to read note or read music. I mean, this had to have been a big help for him, I would have imagined. Because, I mean, it looked like from watching that documentary that, you know, he was able to do, you know, a lot of good things that
you could see him in the documentary, you know, just messing with the computer. And that was like my intro. He's actually got a computer, and that's how he's making this album. That was my just introductory to him composing this. Oh, he's doing it on the computer, almost like, would it have been an early version of Pro Tools before Pro Tools, I guess?
It's a competitor of Pro Tools. I think Pro Tools was available at the time in an early form of it. It was, I think, already called Pro Tools. And Pro Tools subsequently bought a company that was operating on its own. I'm not sure if it was around in 94 or 95, called Sibelius. And Sibelius will actually, you know, you record your stuff, you play it on the keyboard, it will print the music for that. So in a way, you don't have to know notation. Sibelius will do it. Of course, Sibelius also makes mistakes, and if you don't know notation, you can't correct them. But someone can, and he had a team, you know, of composers as his sort of advisors, who took care of that kind of stuff. But Cubase and, you know, any of these programs, and, you know, if you had MIDI available, you set up the MIDI to sound like violins, and it's, you know, it's not going to fool anybody, really. But, you know, but if you, as a composer, just want a recording that will sound a little, you know, more or less like what you're after, that's the way to do it. I mean, I know a lot of classical composers who use all the software I just mentioned and MIDI as well. You know,
I can ask if it's a common practice now to use that to write, you know, music like this.
Yeah, I mean, in 1990 or so, the Metropolitan Opera did an opera called The Ghost of Versailles by a composer named John Corigliano, who lives in New York, and I went to interview him about that before it opened, so there'd never been a performance of it, but he gave me MIDI tapes of the whole thing, you know, so it didn't sound like the orchestra was going to, you know, you could tell it was MIDI, but, you know, it gave a really good approximation of what that thing was going to sound like, so, yeah, you know, it's the kind of thing that would make sense for Paul to use. And, you know, and we know that he has it now, certainly. I don't know what the situation was then, but, yeah, you know, that helps bridge that gap between not knowing how to notate and nevertheless being able to do a pretty complicated classical piece like Standing Stone.
Gotcha. So then, you know, as the year progressed, I mean, he started putting a team together, starting with Dave Matthews, who helped with the first manuscript. Second, brings in John Hale, who was kind of like the architect of overall work. And then he brought in a very colorful figure, I thought he was Sir Richard Rodney Bennett.
Right.
He was pretty much in charge of supervising the orchestration and making any final improvements. But I mean, were you familiar with any of these three going into once you found out? So, you know, he was working with these gentlemen, and were you able to talk to any of them to interview any of them for this project?
I didn't interview any of them for this project. I interviewed Richard Rodney Bennett once before about his own stuff. Richard Rodney Bennett was a very distinguished composer, and also as a sideline, he was like a jazz pianist. He could improvise and do, you know, very, very respectable jazz. John Harl too. John Harl is a saxophone player.
Right.
Who was also a composer, and he was doing things that you could find in different bins of your record store back in the days when there were record stores. You know, but he was a pretty respectable composer. David Matthews, I don't know quite as well. But, you know, they were all, you know, British, for starters, although Richard Rodney Bennett lived in New York. But, you know, Paul's in New York a lot.
Right.
So he basically, I guess, had it set up so that whether he was in New York or in England, one of his advisors was available.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I did notice that they did a lot of work at his Hog Hill studio, so I would imagine he probably was going back and forth.
Yeah.
Obviously, the London Symphony Orchestra was used in a 120-member choir, which, for me personally, once we get into the music, it's my favorite part of the piece, is the choir stuff. But he's writing, but then, you know, he writes this poem, which I think was probably a big help for him as well, because he needed something to write about. You know what I mean? So he, you know, used his Celtic heritage and followed the story of creation from beginnings to the universe to the celebration of love. Obviously, you know, the love theme is in pretty much almost all of his work, you know. The poem, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you've read it. I mean, it's also in his Blackbird Singing book. I like quite a few pieces in the poem, and I was curious about your thoughts and how it's written.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I think it tells the story in a poetic way with lots of, you know, wordplay, but not the kind of wordplay that's meant to be funny. But, you know, the way you can see with him, he sometimes is almost free associating. One word will bring another word to mind. And you kind of wonder in that, you know, what does it mean, actually, when you bring these words together? But that happens with all kinds of poetry, really. You know, I think what he wanted to do, I mean, he talks about it in the booklet, he wanted to basically give himself a roadmap.
Right,
but,
right.
But not just like, you know, a bullet point outline, you know. But in a way, the poem served as the bullet point outline, because once he had the idea of what the story of this piece was going to be, even though the piece was not going to tell the story in words the way Liverpool Oratorio did, I think he wanted to sit down and do another piece of art that would explain it and be kind of a roadmap for him, but also a roadmap for the reader. And, you know, with Paul, I mean, all kinds of things can influence him. You know, there's in Campbelltown, in High Park, his farm up in Scotland, there is a standing stone, you know, within, as one might say, a stone's throw from the actual house.
Right.
And, you know, and that's something that, you know, probably was, you know, among his favorite features of that piece of land for a long time. And Paul lets things percolate, you know. And I think when he was commissioned by EMI, I think he thought that, you know, this might be something that you can build a piece around. And then, okay, when you look at standing stones, I mean, I don't know if you've been to Stonehenge and all those, you know, there are quite a lot of these things all around the British Isles. And everybody is always wondering, I mean, I don't think they've totally gotten to the bottom of what those things were for and how they were done. And, you know, and so these are things that people think about, and Paul just imagined his own history of this particular standing stone, and wrote a story that, you know, and like, as you say, involves, you know, creation, myth, and everything. It's pretty all encompassing. It's, you know, and then the Celtic back history and all of that. It's you know, and then within that, he gets, you know, he's got the ancient mariner coming from the northern seas down to, I guess, Ireland, although it probably wasn't Ireland at the time, and he doesn't call it Ireland. But he comes to port, he erects the standing stone, and then we get into a sort of micro, you know, situation where, you know, we're talking about what his life in that town was, and he helps them go to war against, you know, neighboring enemies, and ultimately, you know, marries one of the town's women. So, you know, again, for that love aspect that, as you say, is so often in his things. So it's a very ambitious,
Right.
kind of piece, including the poem, and there were also some paintings that are really part of this.
I tweeted one of the paintings a couple days ago, and I believe one of them is also in his painting books as well, that you can check out. But there is one little, if I can just read it real quick, that I just like how it's worded, and this is in Movement 2, where it goes, "Salt sea breezes quickened, a shift of silver lifted mist. A crystal ship slipped and shone in sunlight. Seduced, he swam to stand on deck." I think it's pretty cool. I like it.
Yeah. There are a lot of sections like that that are actually pretty good. You know, when you first get this, you think of, well, I don't know how old you guys are, but I mean, I think immediately of the Doors song, "The Crystal Ship." And, you know, but obviously he wasn't going to be put off by the fact that there was a very popular, well-known musical Crystal Ship, because I think he liked the image, you know, and if you think about it, when you read the poem and you push the doors out of your mind and you just think of this image of the crystal ship that the guy's swimming towards and, you know, gets up on the deck of it, it has a kind of, you know, magical, otherworldly, fairy tale-ish, mythical kind of quality. And I think that mythical quality is something he was going for a lot in the poem. And I guess in the piece too, you know.
Segment two of Movement Two is called Crystal Ship. So that's so it's pretty cool. But so let's just get into, it's 75 minutes long. So obviously that was a big help. He talked about how the paintings were a big help too, because it created an image for him that also helped him, to write what he wanted to, get out into this. So so it's the music itself. So you would say it's four parts broken down into 19 pieces. Would that how you would describe it?
Yeah, I'd say it's four movements. excuse me. And the movements are each broken into a number of sort of scenes within the movement. Actually, though, when I was listening to it this afternoon, I was thinking, why is this four movements? I mean, it's continuous. But then again, there are symphonies with four movements that are continuous. Some of them break, stop, start the new movement, stop. Some of them just go on and the movements are connected, and this is one of those. But it could have gone either way. He could have just called it Standing Stone with no movements and just 19 movements instead of four movements with all of these subsections. It is kind of episodic. If you look at the movement, the subsection timings, it's almost as if they're sort of pop song length. And yet they don't have a pop song quality. I mean, they're structurally, they don't work the way pop songs do. They work the way classical pieces do more. So it's really kind of interesting. I mean, I'd love at this point to talk to him about what he had in mind and what he was doing.
John Harrell, I think during the documentary, John Harrell kind of described it as unconventional style of doing something like this, and I was wondering if you would agree with that, because obviously he's not a traditional a composer or writer of classical music.
Right. Yeah, but I don't think there's any single way that classical composers work, especially nowadays. I mean, now classical composers are all over the map, and including using electric guitars and drums and electric bass. So, some of them sit down and write at the piano and, write it down. Some of them just sit at a desk away from instruments and write it,
Alan, do you think this was maybe more of a formal attempt by him to make a more formal, traditional classical album? Because as you had mentioned to your earlier point, Standing Liverpool Oratorio had much more popular music qualities to it. In terms of the song, the song structure, and Standing Stone maybe was more of an attempt to him to make a proper classical album. Do you think that was maybe the case with this one?
I think so. I think he was aiming a little higher. The problem is that really, if you're starting to do this, things like Spiral and A Leaf and the other short pieces kind of make a lot more sense, because there's an awful lot to deal with in 75 minutes. And it could have been almost overreaching. I mean, I have to say, I liked it a lot more hearing it now than I did when it came out. And someone did an interview with me when it came out, and I was making this point about how composers often start with shorter pieces and make their way to the 75-minute or hour, whatever, larger pieces. And the interviewer said, well, but what if what he wanted to do was 75 minutes? And I said, look, I have in my house a little recording studio, which I'm talking to you from right now. and I may want to do Sergeant Pepper, but if I'm just starting to do this, it might make sense for me to do Love Me Do first, you know, please me, and get to Sgt. Pepper. You know, that said, he did have a reasonably good idea of what he wanted, and he knows enough about how music works, especially, you know, if he had questions, he has this team of three people he could talk to who were very experienced and were happy to help. So, you know, I think he was better off than a lot of composers who may just be starting in classical music, you know. But, yeah.
But he did have a little bit of experience working on shorter classical pieces. I mean, he did do the piece that his father wrote. The name of
That's
it
right.
is, you know, escaping me at the
Walking
moment.
In the Park with Eloise.
That's right. Thank you. So, I mean, he did, you know, and I'm sure he learned a lot from working with George Martin as well in that. And plus, he did conduct the middle and end segments of A Day in the Life as well. So, I mean, he did right. have the, you know, little experiences with classical music. So I guess that would make him feel a little bit more comfortable doing it.
I mean, A Day in the Life, basically the instruction was to go from your lowest note to your highest note, not at the same speed as your neighbor, and he was just providing sort of what the beat was. But what you said about working with George Martin is a very good point, because, you know, when they did the arrangement for Yesterday, which is George Martin's arrangement, but Paul was there also saying what ideas he had in mind, and one of the best moments of Yesterday's string writing is, you know, what the cello does moving down that particular way. It's really an incredible moment. And George Martin has said that that was Paul. So, you know, I mean, look, this is an extremely musical guy. I mean, I know it's stating the obvious, but you know, this is something he wanted to do. I found, you know, I went back and read my reviews
yes, what were your initial thoughts of it after it was released?
I didn't like it as much as Liverpool Oratorio, because to me, okay, one of the things Paul says a lot about why he doesn't want to learn notation, partly because he thinks it will inhibit him, which is kind of silly. I mean, I know how to write English. It doesn't inhibit me when I want to sit down and write something. It's really just a system for getting your ideas onto a piece of paper. But the other thing that he's often said is, you know, I think sometimes if you, you know, write and you know too much about it, and you know, you run into the possibility of accidentally plagiarizing. And the example he gave was Leonard Bernstein's song Somewhere, which is an awful lot like the slow movement of Beethoven's Second Piano Concerto. But that wasn't an accidental case of plagiarism. It was an homage. I mean, Leonard Bernstein knows what the second movement of Beethoven's Second Piano Concerto sounds like. He lifted that. It's out of copyright. And, you know, his song isn't just that. I mean, it's, you know, but if you know the Beethoven, you hear Somewhere, beautiful song, and you think, oh, yeah, it's a little like the Beethoven. And I think Paul was afraid of that. Now, having said all that, the fact is that Paul does know an awful lot of classical music. I mean, I knew an usher at Carnegie Hall who, like, you know, a lot of the time I'd be there and he'd say, hey, Paul was here the other day. You know, he just comes in, slips in the back, listens. You know, he goes to lots of classical music. When he was, I think, on Desert Island Discs, he picked a Julian Green recording of a Benjamin Britten piece. So, you know, and not to mention that, you know, in 66, after the tour, George went to India, John went to film How I Won the War. Paul spent a lot of time going to avant-garde classical music concerts and listening to Luciano Berio and Stockhausen and you know, all kinds of other people. So he knows the stuff. And the problem is that because he knows the stuff, but doesn't necessarily live it, you know, 24 hours a day. He seemed to me, at least, in this piece, to sort of adopt an approach where, okay, if I want a battle kind of scene or war or whatever, Shostakovich has a lot of that kind of stuff. And so suddenly the music sounds a bit like Shostakovich. He uses moves that Shostakovich uses. Same with, you know, when this old sailor is up in the Northern Sea, we hear a lot of music that sounds a little like Sibelius. You know, it's not actual lifts from Sibelius, but it's like, okay, Sibelius was great at capturing that northern sound. What did he do? This is what I'm doing. For watery imagery, the French Impressionists were spectacular at that. And, you know, and Paul knows all this stuff. And the problem for me was that parts of it sounded a little bit, at least originally, not so much when I heard it again today, like I said. It seemed a little paint-by-number-ish in a way. It's like, okay, here we need the sort of sailing on the ocean, so we've got the Debussy Ravel kind of textures. Here we're in the north, it's the Sibelius, we got war, it's Shostakovich. And, you know, and there's another small point I can make about why he might have thought of things that way. Once when I interviewed him before Liverpool Oratorio came out, when he was shopping it around, he didn't necessarily want to go to EMI Classics. So he went to Deutsche Grammophon and other labels. And he was saying to me, you know, it's currently a Deutsche Grammophon. I don't know what they're going to do with it. But, you know, they're tough. I mean, they turned down the Andrew Lloyd Webber Requiem, and that's pretty good, isn't it? And the thing is that, to me, Andrew Lloyd Webber is the devil. And I just can't stand. And the Andrew Lloyd Webber Requiem was, again, to me, a total piece of garbage. And the thing is that with Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem, he did sort of what I'm complaining about with Paul. He used a lot of Prokofiev, except that with Andrew Lloyd Webber, you could tell which pieces he was lifting. You know, with Paul, it's just he's taking the style. And, you know, that's okay. But at the end of my review of the record, I think it was, I said, you know, it's great that he's doing this, but maybe he wants to keep his, you know, student experiments. And I didn't mean student condescendingly. It's just that he was learning this, right? And he's seriously learning it. That maybe he wants to keep those under wraps until he finds a style that is entirely his own. You know, that you could pick up. Look, you could pick up one of his pop things. And, okay, it's got his voice on it. But, you know, a McCartney song has lots of hallmarks that you could latch onto even if someone else is doing it and say, that sounds like something Paul would do, you know, and you find out, you know, maybe it was something Paul wrote for someone else. And with this, what I wanted was for him to have his own sort of thumbprint as a classical composer, too. And another thing that bothered me a little bit about it, and again, bothered me less today when I heard it, was that he seemed to be drawing a lot on the music of the past. Now, Shostakovich was in the, you know, he died in 76, so it's not that much of the past, but you know, a lot of these things are, it just seemed to be odd to me that Paul was the one who was making the tape loops and bringing them into Beatles sessions. He was the one going to the avant-garde concerts. And I kind of was hoping that Paul would do some of his really experimental stuff as his classical music, because that's what current classical music is. And I wanted him to write, to make, you know, good contributions to the world of current classical music, not classical music that sounds like past classical music. That was my problem with Echo Cormeum, too.
Okay. But you didn't get any of that with the opening Fire Rain segment? Because, I mean, it did seem that there it was a lot on the experimental side or avant-garde side.
There was a bit of that in that opening section. And, in fact, there were little bits of it here and there throughout the piece, too. And I think, you know, here's the thing. You listen to music as a critic, and you listen to it every day, and something new every day, and you think of it differently than if you listen to it casually. And today, it was sort of in between those two. I mean, I knew I had to come on and talk about it, so I needed to sort of refresh my ideas about what I felt about this piece, and yet I wasn't going to be writing a review. I wasn't going to have to be coming up with, you know, an opinion in, you know, a little place like the New York Times that people might see. And, you know, the weight of writing for the Times is, you know, sometimes. But,
well, you brought up something interesting. It's just like, can the Alan Kozin fan enjoy it, but the Alan Kozin reviewer has to...
Yeah, separating critic from fandom. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The Alan Kozin fan of Paul's work, you know, is very open to what he wants to do and can enjoy various things casually. I mean, look, there are things I don't like. I mean, I'm not crazy about Ué le Soleil, you know. But with this, you know, listening to it casually, because I, apart from listening to it today, since I was going to be on for some time, I listened to it, you know, here and there over the last few weeks. And a lot of the time I had it on, but was doing other things. And, you know, which is not normally, not the way I listen to music if I'm reviewing. And, you know, and I was thinking, you know, this is actually pretty enjoyable. And, you know, I have to say that even listening to it today, I did a very focused, close listening, and I did enjoy it. And I did hear more of the contemporary things than I think I heard in 1997, or, you know, maybe I was just too... Yeah, here's the thing. As a fan, you can just enjoy it if you want to. As a critic, you are expected to... write about it in the same terms that you would write about it if it wasn't someone who you were a fan of, and in the context of all contemporary classical music. So if he's putting out something that sounds like a throwback to an earlier era, that can be perfectly enjoyable. But if you're supposed to be holding up some sort of standard about what classical music in 1997 is, it seemed like it was, you know, a little more of a throwback piece. Now, another thing that has changed since 1997 is that the classical music world itself has morphed quite a lot. And, you know, without getting into what all of the stylistic battles in the classical music world have been, the thing is... Neo-Romanticism and, you know, things that draw heavily on the non-dissonant past and non-avant-garde past have become, I think, they've settled in and become much more acceptable now to classical listeners and classical critics than they were at that point. I mean, classical music is a slave to fashion just like anything else, in a way, you know?
I was going to ask you about recent classical, because you still write reviews for classical pieces.
True, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you your feelings about classical music today as well. So, but you're doing that right now, so go ahead and continue.
Okay, you know, today... What you have is, you know, when I got out of school, and which was in like 1976 or so, I had been trained as a guitar was my principal instrument, but I also had studied composition and keyboard, and I played other instruments as well. And I got out, and what I really wanted to do, I think, was be a composer. I ended up writing about music because to me that was a whole lot easier. And I thought, you know, originally thought I'll do that for a while, make some money, support myself while also doing composition, but it's kind of hard. But as a composer, one dilemma that I was looking at in 1976 was, you know, I have these two sides. I'm a rock guy too, you know, and I'm probably the first generation of people who've gone through music school and are just as happy playing rock as classical music. Right. And that wasn't that common in those days. Okay, fast forward to now. It's totally common. There's now been like two or three generations that have done that. Kids get out of Juilliard. They know all the finesse of classical music composition, but they've also played in rock bands. They come out and they look around like I did at the time. I looked around and said, you know, it's either classical or rock. I can't obviously do both. Kids come out now and they say, okay, I'm not getting the big commission from the New York Philharmonic or from EMI or whatever. I have a bunch of friends and some of them play violin, cello, viola, and flute. And then these guys play electric guitar, bass, and drums. And I'm just going to write for them because they're my friends. I like them. I like what they do. And I'm writing the pieces. And so suddenly there's this ensemble that's hybrid. And they go and play at a place like Le Poisson Rouge in New York, which some nights puts on rock, some nights puts on indie rock, some nights puts on classical music. And the audience for that place will come to any of these things. And so what you have now is a far greater openness in style. You want to write neo-romantic stuff for, you know, strings and winds? Great. You want to write edgier stuff that has, you know, amplified instruments and guitars and drums? Great. You know, it's almost, you know, not quite anything goes, but it's closer to that. And also, when I got out, I mean, there was out of school, there was a great value placed on the sort of more dissonant side of classical music. There was a technique called 12 tone, where you take the 12 notes of the scale, you make yourself a series, and you break it up various ways, but you know, it's based on that. The idea was to not be a slave to tonality. So things weren't necessarily in the key of C or D or whatever. They were just, it was just completely chromatic. Very high value placed on that in those days. But also then minimalism came out, you know, playing very consonant music in a key and very repetitive. And there was a big sort of war between those two camps. I mean, people in either side of it thought that what the other was doing was not even music, you know. But now, again, those same kids getting out of Juilliard, they've studied both sides of those. They have no, you know, dog in that fight. They're perfectly happy doing both. And so their pieces have both. And, you know, at the time, I think I was a little more committed to greater dissonance than Paul was putting in these things. Although, as you say, in the very beginning, there is a bunch of that and here and there throughout the piece when needed. But, yeah, it's changed a lot. And I think that that this piece has survived better than I thought it would.
Cool. You know? Do you think he utilized the choir properly?
I think the choir's great. Yeah,
it really left me wanting more when I listened to it earlier today as well. You know, this was like my third or fourth time listening to it, and I really dig that choir. And it's just not there as much as I would have liked to have heard it.
Agree.
But that's
agree
a good
too.
Thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's like leave them wanting more. You know, I think he uses the choir very well. And it's, you know, I think that even the use of the choir is more interesting than I didn't say anything negative about it at the time in 1997. But I think it hadn't really hit me as much as it did today how important that choir is and how he's basically using the choir as another instrumental section of the orchestra, you know, except at the end, because they're not singing the text, they're just singing, you know, syllables, but it's beautiful and it's fantastic, and it plays into this kind of mythical thing that he's got going in this piece. So yeah, I agree with you. I think the choir is really important to this, and you know, it's, you know, and they also they got a pretty good choir here, so.
yeah, because I was a little worried because, you know, when we were doing the Liverpool Oratorio, and as we were winding down with that conversation, you had just come out and said, you know, now, you know, I'm not a big fan of the Standing Stone, but it's cool that you did go back and listen to it, and now you're appreciating it more than you did back then. So I guess we can, you know, end this part as a positive. You know?
I guess I have to go back and listen to Echo Cormeum now too, because the same issues with that.
Right, so I didn't know, because I mean, obviously, I would love to have you back to talk about Working Classical or the other one you just mentioned too that I always have a hard time pronouncing. but obviously, we, you know, further on down the line, we'd love to have you back to talk about those pieces as well. So
I just had a quick question for Alan, real quick, just as we kind of sum up this part of it. Yeah, Tom had mentioned, and you guys had mentioned, obviously his role in working with George Martin and kind of learning his chops with classical music back in the 60s. Interesting enough, though, on all these albums, Liverpool Oratorio and Standing Stone, George Martin, to my knowledge, really was not involved in the process. And I was curious, for somebody who learned the ropes with classical music, it's very curious that he distanced himself from George Martin for these works and didn't maybe call upon him to listen to it or review it or give his input on them. I was always fascinated by that.
Well, we don't know that he didn't. He might have.
Right.
But
nothing
George
officially.
Didn't produce
nothing,
it.
Right. Nothing, yeah. Nothing officially.
It could be that, you know, because John Fraser was EMI Classical producer, that the label itself wanted him to do it. And, you know, he probably met with Paul and they got on. And, you know, Paul has used lots of producers for his pop things, too. And it's also possible, well, I don't know, I shouldn't speculate, because George Martin did some classical things well after this, I don't really know the answer to that. It is an interesting question. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, at some point they had dinner and Paul said, so listen to some of this, what do you think?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, because George Martin, classically trained, you know, you would think he would be very keen to, you know, listen to some of this work that he was writing at the time.
Of course, you know, by the time he did both of these pieces, George Martin's hearing was,
starting to go, yeah.
Not in great shape. And he, for that reason himself, wanted to wind down to a great degree.
Sure.
So there's that. But, you know, also George Martin, I don't know if you're ever going to look at the Family Way as part of Paul's classical, you know, actually George Martin did a huge amount of weightlifting in that piece, because Paul was commissioned to write the film score. At the time, he talked in interviews about possibly doing it with John, which could have been interesting, but John was off filming and Paul just sort of sat down and came up with some ideas for this, but really he wrote what amounted to 15 seconds worth of music.
Wow.
And the rest, George Martin spun out from that 15 seconds.
Would that be like the
music.
Main theme of Love in the Open Air? I guess that it, or was that the basis of that piece, I guess?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And the rest is variations on that, you know, in different ways and different ways of doing it, different instrumentation, and it gives the impression of being a full score, but there's not an awful lot of substance. You know, Paul sort of, he must have lost interest or something, you know, because only coming up with 15 seconds doesn't sound like him.
So this is a good segue to now talk about the McCartney legacy that you and Adrian St. Clair are now working on, and you guys are starting with this project, right? The Family Way,
right?
Project.
Cool. Well, I'm not sure what we're doing with the Family Way. If it were totally up to me, and you know, when you're in a partnership, you toss things back and forth, and I understand Adrian's point of view too. You know, if it were totally up to me, I'd start the book with the Family Way, because it's the first thing that he did that was solo, and this is a book about his life as a solo artist, you know, because, you know, you get Paul McCartney books and they're this thick and everything up to here is about the Beatles and his 50 years of work.
And
we wanted to take seriously this 50 years of work, you know, all of it. And so it's a multi-volume set. I should say it. Adrian originated the idea. Adrian is he lives in England, in Yorkshire. He is a documentarian, a film editor. He does a lot of work for TV, and although he's pretty much stopped to work on this, and he's, you know, he's not 40 yet, you know, and yet he knows this stuff inside out.
Wow.
And is an incredible researcher. So it began with Adrian getting in contact with me through one of the many sort of quasi-secret Beatles collecting groups on the internet. And, you know, we knew each other from that anyway. And he said, listen, I'm doing this project, and I was wondering if you might want to participate. What he wanted to do was something like, you know, originally Mark Lewisohn's Beatles Recording Sessions book for Paul. And my job was supposed to be to write the sort of biographical wraparound for each album. You know, what was going on in his life at the time? What was he doing? You know, what other concerns? And Adrian would deal with the session info. And I said, yeah, okay, we could do that. And originally, it was a very amorphous plan, like maybe we'll do, you know, a series of PDFs or something. But, you know, it's hard to do that if you also are busy doing your jobs, which for him was film editing, for me was, you know, writing and reviewing and all that. So for the first few years, we just sort of would keep in touch about it, send things back and forth. But Adrian was doing a lot of work and I wasn't doing an awful lot because my part was going to depend on his anyway, you know. For a while, we had Chip Manager involved, and because it seemed to me that, you know, if this is what we're going to do, Chip has already done a lot of work, you know, up to, what, 2000 or so on Eight Arms.
Yeah.
And so it might make sense to bring Chip in. And Chip came in and he said basically, okay, here's the thing. I now have my own publishing company, which I'm doing the Lennonology books through. Mm-hmm. And, excuse me, maybe what we could do is publish the McCartney books as part of the same series, in which case I will be the publisher and editor, and I will be listed as a co-author, but you guys are the authors. And we said, yeah, that's fine, because, you know, two authors is already one more than I'm used to. Three, I don't know how that would go. But in the end, you know, Chip had various style concerns and other things, and he really was busy with continuing on Lennonology, and we basically had an amicable parting of ways. And I said to Adrian, look, if we're going to do this, we really should go to an actual publisher and try to sell it so that we can get an advance, and that would buy us time from our regular jobs to do the research and writing for this book. That's what advances are for. And he said, yeah, okay. So I got us an agent, and he surprisingly quickly was able to sell it to Day Street Books, which is a division of HarperCollins. They took a cautious view. They bought the first two volumes, which is fundamentally the Wings era. The first volume goes up to 73 and Band on the Run and the breakup of the first Wings. And the second one will go to 79 or 80.
Okay.
So basically the way we're doing it is like we're both doing some research and you know, we're both doing interviews. Adrian is doing an awful lot of the library research and that kind of thing. I mean, there are tons of articles about Paul out there that have not been seen since they were first printed and have lots of interesting info. You know, plus we're interviewing people and, you know, asking them about some of these things we're reading. Adrian will write up a chapter or part of a chapter, or for one album he'll do a thing about each piece and what went on at the sessions and the dates and engineers, all that stuff, and draw on quotes from some of the interviews, and he'll send it to me, and I will often, you know, sort of rewrite that so that we have, so stylistically we have a similar, you know, the book all looks like it's written by a single person. And plus I'm writing stuff of my own, and I'm adding stuff to what Adrian sent, and then Adrian's adding stuff to what Adrian said. You know, we have WhatsApp open on the screen all the time, and, you know, every now and then a note will come on from Adrian saying, I just found this. Oh, well, okay, that was in chapter two, and I think we should add it. So I'll go back to chapter two and put that thing back in. So that's how it's working.
Gotcha. So let's just, so you've been working, guys, have probably been working on this, what, 2-3 years now?
More than that. It's like 5 or 6, really.
Wow.
Go ahead.
We've only been working on it officially, meaning since Day Street Books signed it. Since last spring, really. Gotcha. It might even be as late as July.
Yeah, I think the official press release, I think it was July, I think, when you announced it.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So has any of your negative or positive thoughts about McCartney changed while working on this series? I mean, have you found anything out that... I mean, last time you were here, you talked about the Let It Be, or the Live and Let Die situation with George Martin taking the song to the movie producers. But has there been anything that you've been surprised to learn since then?
Well, yeah, we found a lot of dates that, I mean, I can't really specifically go into them, but we found a lot of dates that are given in a lot of McCartney timelines and other books, and even in some of the deluxe editions, that are just wrong. You know, we found paperwork that shows when they actually were. And so we'll be able to provide a more accurate timeline for everything. A lot of things, you know, some of these deluxe editions, much as we love them, sort of like wreck some of our surprises. I mean, for instance, you know, I think it wasn't apparent to a lot of people how much of Red Rose Speedway was recorded during the Ram sessions until that box set came out and made that absolutely clear. And we had already gotten to the bottom of that. And so that was something that we... in a way, we're sorry to see come out publicly before the book came out, but you know what? We're happy to have it.
So, quick researching question, Alan. As a researcher myself, who's spent a lot of time in England, and also at the British Library, I'm curious, are you using mostly British periodicals and like the old British weeklies like Melody Maker for your sources? Are you using American research primary
resources?
We're
using everything that we can find. I mean... keep in mind as well, I mean, Adrian is, I think, on his library mining trips, focusing largely on the British publications. I have boxes and boxes full of American publications that I collected over all these years. So, you know, that's sort of handy as well.
Yeah.
There's like a 1 or 2 volumes of this. I don't know if you've seen this before.
Sure.
Yeah, but... yeah, this has all the, like, the McCartney clippings, I think, from the British...
it has great stuff, but, you know, the problem with that book is that a lot of the times the sources aren't given, you know?
Right.
Sometimes you tell from the typographical stuff.
Right, we need to know the source. Where's the source from?
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, sometimes it's there. I mean, I wondered, you know, did he take New Musical Express off because he didn't want to, like, flag the copyright violation of reprinting it? But then sometimes it's in there.
Yeah.
So it's inconsistent. It's like someone had a scrapbook and reproduced it, and when they kept the scrapbook, they didn't necessarily care what the sources
where it came from. Yeah.
but now it's a book. You know, what has to happen sometimes when I page through that book and find something is then I will then have to go through our files and try and find the real article, because know, if we cite something in an article or take a quote from a published interview, obviously we have to footnote it, and we need all of that info for the footnote.
Sure.
So,
you know, one of the things we did on Talk More Talk was we talked about whether or not, you know, Wings belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and whether or not they're a band, you know, or you know, quote unquote, a traditional band, if you will. And one of the arguments I wanted to bring up that I wasn't able to find anything on, and I, you know, hopefully you were able to in this first chapter, because obviously Wings, you know, starts before this first book ends, was, you know, how were they paid? Was there any contracts at all, or was it all just more of a handshake type deal, you know? Or, I mean, obviously, if you don't want to talk about it to give anything away from the book, I understand that, but I'm just...
Yeah, okay, I can tell you some of it. A lot of that is going to come up more in Volume 2, because there weren't contracts. There was just an agreement.
Right.
Around 74... they began talking about contracts. Some of them wanted contracts. For some reason, Denny Lane in particular did not want a contract. I can't think why. Adrian might have gotten to the bottom of why, but I can't remember offhand, because Adrian is now knee deep in research for book two, and I'm writing book one. So we're in different places, sort of, and he's, but I hear, you know, the interviews that he does, and I do some, and so I hear some of that stuff. But there was, when they were in Nashville in 74, there was talk about contracts. They were supposed to do contracts then. And they ended up not doing contracts for a number of reasons, but one of which was that Denny was opposed. So, and I don't know yet whether the subsequent versions got contracts, but I kind of doubt it. Yeah, it's, however, you know, the financial arrangements changed a lot over the years. I mean, you have, and we've been running into people who are polar opposites, from, yeah, Paul, you know, could have paid us better and all that stuff, to,
right,
Paul was extremely generous, and he paid, you know, when the, you know, Japan tour was canceled, all the musicians got paid,
okay,
all of that stuff. So, you know, there are different people have different views of how they felt about what happened, but, you know, most of the people that, you know, I did a bunch of the interviews for that 74 period as well, and, you know, we talked to them, and they volunteered that he paid them. I mean, you know, we asked some of them, and some of them just came up with it themselves, that, you know, everything was paid, and, you know, even if they didn't end up playing those gigs, they weren't out the money. He was very fair about that.
Gotcha. So when can we expect Volume 1?
Okay, well, Volume 1 is due this October, and ooh, comes out a year after that or so.
Okay.
Volume 2 is due in, I believe, 2022, and will come out in 2023.
So Volume 1, 2022, and then
Volume 2. Volume 1 will be out in, like, stores in 2021.
Oh, okay, so October 2021...
Close to
22. Gotcha. So, I mean, are you going to give us time for a pre-order, are you thinking? Or are you just going to say, here it is, and buy away? I mean, what are you thinking on the release?
Well, this is the thing about having an actual publisher. It's kind of up to them.
Gotcha.
I imagine, like anything else, you know, it'll be available for pre-order on Amazon or, you know,
right,
however else people buy books. And just,
yeah, because, you know, I'm a big fan of those A's for Apple series. I'm not sure if you're aware of, you know,
yes, I got a notice the other day.
Yeah, so, you know,
I already ordered it.
So I love the cover too. The you know, the Klein title too is pretty cool. So yeah, I think those guys are doing pretty good work over there, and looking forward to that. But is there anything else you can tell us about the book, or if not, what do you got going on? What else do you got going on that you can plug, or any anything else?
Actually, the book is sort of almost full time now for me. I mean, I still am doing a few concerts covering, and but I'm really trying to cut back on as much as I can to focus on the book, because it's a huge amount of information and I'm pretty fast, but October is only 9 months or so from now. So, and we still have a lot to cover. I'm actually still in the McCartney album, believe it or not. I mean, we've done some of the later stuff too. We did, as you know, Live and Let Die, and various other things later on, which I'll sync up with. For instance, I've done all the home sessions. Now I'm doing the Morgan and EMI sessions, and that will wrap that up. I mean, apart from all the nonsense that went on about when he could put the album out, the whole first, the first couple of chapters. On one hand, we wanted to avoid writing another Beatle book. The fact is that, the McCartney album and his whole solo career comes out of the wreckage of the Beatles. So we had to explain the wreckage of the Beatles. So that starts really in 1969. And I don't go into great detail about the Let It Be and Abbey Road sessions, but they're there because it's part of the timeline. Everything else is going on too with Klein and trying to get, they wanted to get control of NEMS and they wanted to get control of Northern Songs. And Northern Songs especially, remains to this day an issue for Paul. So these things have to be gone into. And so the first couple of chapters kind of do that. Chapter 3 finally gets into the home sessions. Yeah.
If you can just answer yes or no, you don't have to get into great detail, but do we know, or did you guys find out exactly when he wanted to, make it public that, that article that came in on, April 10th that he's leaving the Beatles? Do you know how the timeline when he wanted to do that? I mean, was it like that day or the day before? I mean, do we know exactly when he wanted to do that?
He actually did it first on November 1st, 1969.
In the Life magazine. He said it in the Life magazine.
The Life magazine, right. He said the Beatles thing is over.
Nobody knows it.
Right. You know that. I mean, but do we kind of know, when he went to that? I mean, he had to go to the newspaper to, authorize this, this bit to come out on April 10th, right?
Right. Well, the thing is, he put it in his self-interview that went out with the press release. So once you put out a press release, anything in the press release is authorized to go out. So, I don't think he went to a specific paper with it, but once he did that, he knew what he was doing. But if you look at that self-interview,
right.
He does ask himself, do you think it'll ever work again? And he doesn't say flat no. It's sort of like, maybe we'll see. He gives the impression that he's fed up with it, but he does not totally close the door on it. And neither were the others, despite the fact that they all knew that they were broken up, kind of. When they had the session for I Me Mine on January 3rd, 70, it was everyone but John, the one guy who wanted to break up. Now, George wasn't at that meeting because his mother had been diagnosed with cancer, so he was off visiting his mother. And so he didn't hear – actually, there was a tape of that meeting too, just like the one on September 9th. So he would have heard by then, what happened. But all three of them sat there during part of that session and said, so what do you think? Is he really leaving or what? And they decided to just sort of wait and see. But by then, Paul had pretty decisively decided that his home recordings were going to be the basis of an album. I mean, originally he was saying, I'm not sure. What I want to do is get this Studer 4-track set up in my house and do some very high-quality demos that if I want to use them, I can. But I don't know yet whether I'm going to want to use them. And I think it wasn't until the end of the year when those sessions were mostly finished that he looked back at what he had and he said, you know, this is the basis of something, but I would like to get back into a real studio. Because, you know, keep in mind with the Studer, he didn't have a mixing board. He didn't have VU meters. So it meant that he had to mostly start with drums, which he wouldn't necessarily have to do in a real studio. And if you're starting with drums, that kind of changes the character of what you're doing in a way. That's why so many of those instrumentals are sort of jammy instrumentals, because the drums go first and then he's reacting in a way to that. Although he does seem to know more or less what he wanted to do, or he did seem to know more or less what he wanted to do on those tracks. But then he decided, you know, by the end of December, before he went to Liverpool for New Year's with his family, he decided that, yeah, okay, I want to go into the studio with these tapes, add some things, record some new things, make this into a real album. And so he had Linda book studio time at Morgan. I think principally at Morgan, because he could just probably walk into EMI and get the time he needed. But Morgan was a different, you know, it was an independent studio, and he didn't have quite that relationship with it, although he'd used it before. So Jethro Tull was recording the Benefit album at the time. And so their main studio was booked until February. So it took a while, but he booked the sessions under the name Billy Martin, because he wanted to keep it secret. And yet it leaked out anyway. You know, a number of publications in their February 21st issue, and I think one in February 14th, 70 issue, said Paul is working on some new songs for a new album.
Cool.
You know, so
that's really interesting. You know, I can speak for Andy that we're really looking forward to this book, and I wouldn't be doing my podcasting duties if I didn't mention that I would, you know, absolutely love to have you and Adrian on when this book comes out, and hopefully we can, you know, work that out, because it's just, you know, we need something like this. I mean, I think Andy, you've said, you know, many times that since what 2010 we've really finally started to get, you know, a lot of books out about McCartney. And I think this is going to definitely be, you know, the cherry on top
Yeah, this will really be something that I personally have been looking forward to for the better part of my life. So I'm really looking forward to this kind of research dedicated to this career. Because as you pointed out, Alan, you look at just 90% of all the books on McCartney, like this much is on, you know, the Beatles. And there's this much dedicated for 50 years or 40 years of his own career. And it's just, it's a shame. And I'm kudos to you guys for finally, you know, getting together to do this project.
I mean, even many years from now is mostly the Beatles.
Yes.
You know? So, and that's as close as he's come to an autobiography.
Yeah.
You know what I did tonight? Since tomorrow, I'm going to be spending some time writing about Carina Crore. Tonight, right before we started, I watched The Tribe That Hides from Man, which is the TV special that he watched the night before he wrote and recorded the song, and was really interesting. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I love to read about. And once again, you know, we're really happy that you're here. I mean, do you want to give any contact information for anybody that wants to, you know, reach out to you?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to get to me is through Facebook. And I have two Facebook pages. One is Alan Kozin. One is Alan Kozin Remixed, which my wife started because she thought I should have a friendlier Facebook page because Alan Kozin was mostly my New York Times stuff. So now Alan Kozin is mostly classical stuff, and Alan Kozin Remixed is mostly the Beatles stuff. So for this discussion, I don't know, we probably put them on both.
Yeah, we could.
But and also, I mean, my email address is just alankozin@gmail.com. The name is spelled A-L-L-A-N-K-O-Z as in zebra, I-N-N, at gmail.com. So I'm pretty easily reachable.
How about a website for the book, Alan?
Ah, there is one. And I don't know the address offhand.
There is a Facebook page, I think, the McCartney Legacy. So you can check out there.
And that, I think, has a link to the webpage, which Adrian had set up.
I got it. It's McCartney Legacy, McCartneyLegacy.co.uk.
Cool.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
it has a couple of articles on it. When I interviewed Mike McCartney, which is really for Volume 2.
Right.
Pretty much the first thing in Volume 2. And because his album was being reissued mid-year, we decided that we would do a little piece for the website, you know, and I think as we come closer to the book, we're going to put more and more things up there to, you know, tantalize people.
Right, give a little tease.
Absolutely, yes. Well, like I said, we're both looking forward and we can't wait. Andy, is there, anything else you'd like to add before we...
Not sure. You can, as Tom mentioned at the top of the show, we've had to kind of rebrand our Facebook page for whatever reason, and I kind of handle the technical end of the editing and of our podcast, and also on our YouTube page, which this will go on in a couple of days, and hopefully Tom can kind of blast out some more people for our Facebook page, and you can find and contact us on there. My personal Facebook page is Andy Nichols. I'm also on there as well, and you can contact me at andynichols@gmail.com if you have any questions about our show as well.
Cool. So Two Legs, we're everywhere. We're on Instagram and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. Our email address is twolegspodcast@gmail.com. As Andy said, we are on YouTube at Two Legs. Please check that out and subscribe to that. And you can see, Alan Cozen's wonderful face, which, like I said earlier, unless you're at the Fest or Symposium, you usually don't see. What else? Like I said, we had the redo our Facebook page, so please take the time to go over there and like that page. And once again, we really appreciate everybody taking the time to listen to our show. We have a lot of fun doing it. I have a lot of fun, bringing in guests such as Alan on to talk about, Paul's, now, 50-year solo career, which is just amazing the more and more you look at it. And again, as always, everybody have a great day and a beautiful night. So long.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan Seaver.